From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a truck stop in Iowa. A presidential candidate spent an hour talking to truck drivers about their work futures. He was asking them, first, a simple question. Do you think robots could take your job? At first, they answered, no, no way. But given some time to consider the evidence, their tune changed. Artificial intelligence has already impacted human lives in tremendous ways. This hour, our goal is to discuss what we want and expect out of AI. That presidential candidate was Democrat Andrew Yang, who views the creep of automation as inevitable. He says we're too often focused on fast food when AI is taking jobs away in almost every conceivable profession. At a recent presidential debate, CNN moderator Aaron Burnett referred to a recent study that found about a quarter of American jobs could be lost to automation in just the next decade. AI could even take jobs from journalists because AI is being crafted to write stories based on press releases, and we already know that newsrooms are shrinking. Writing for Slate Online, Jordan Weissman's headline sums up how he feels about this automation debate. That headline reads, quote, Andrew Yang is full of it. Weissman writes that, yes, AI could threaten some or many jobs, but he adds that this is not inevitable, and the solution is not to simply declare defeat and hand out $1,000 a month for every American. Weissman writes, quote, the real problem with Yang's outlook is that it's lazy. When you buy the sci-fi notion that technology is simply a disembodied force making humanity obsolete and that there's little that can be done about it, you stop thinking about ideas that will actually prevent workers from being screwed over by the forces of globalization or new tech. End quote. So this hour, we ask if the AI revolution is inevitable, what it's going to look like, if there are ways to steer or limit the creep of it. Our guests this hour include Matt Kelly, an independent journalist. It's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And tell people where they can find most of your recent work is on bees, and which we've talked about. So where do they usually find you?
For the bee work, they can find me at thebeereport.com. But for my general work, they can find me at bymattkelly.com.
All right. Also with us in studio is Ehsan Hawk, who is the Asaro Bigger Family Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Rochester. Ehsan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Hadi Hosseini, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at RIT. Welcome to you as well.
Wonderful to be here.
Now, when Matt and I first talked, this was originally going to be a conversation about newsrooms and AI.
Right.
You know, because when we look at the way technology, AI, is being trained to write the news without humans writing the news, we were kind of talking about, well, what does this actually mean for journalism? We know journalism is shrinking to begin with. It broadened from there. But let me just briefly ask you, as a journalist, does that bother or worry you, or do you think there are benefits?
Well, I am simultaneously fascinated and fearful of what AI could do. And I think to boil a really long conversation down to a quick intro is this idea that I think any technology that we are creating requires thoughtfulness, right? And I think that's really what we want to talk about with AI. And I think this is a great point to talk about it with AI. We know that AI can produce a lot of really interesting benefits for humans. We also know that there's the great potential for it to spin out of control as a black box that is just this mysterious device of output that we have no understanding about how it's making decisions or how to correct those decisions.
I'm staking my flag proudly as an AI alarmist, and I want to tell our guests why. Because I think if there's a non-zero chance for the most dark scenarios to play out, that we ought to at least be very, very blunt about considering them and talking about them and discussing it. And, you know, when Matt and I were talking, you framed it, and I'm giving you this credit. I don't know if you're sort of drawing from someone else, but there's a really interesting framing that I had never thought about, which is that when we think about tools, tools tend to enhance human capacity, not replace the need for human capacity. Is that a dividing line for you? Tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, no, that is definitely a dividing line. If I'm drawing from somebody, it's unintentionally. It may be through a series of things.
I'm totally going to quote you on this then. I like that. That's good.
So I think what is fascinating is if you look at the history of humankind, right? I mean, what allowed us to evolve and come out of the jungle and become successful is the fact that we had brains, that we had opposable thumbs, and we created tools to enhance our capabilities as humans, right? And anything from a hammer to a car to a cell phone is a device that enhances something that a human can inherently do, whether it's do work, whether it's locomotion, whether it's communication. All of these things are devices that enhance the skills that we inherently have as creatures. I don't have a great way of talking about this with AI, but the way I've referred to it is black box, right? Something that doesn't necessarily enhance what humans do, but replaces what humans do. And for me, yeah, that is definitely the dividing line in this conversation about AI. Does it enhance and make it possible for us to do greater things as humans, or does it actually take us out of the equation?
All right, let me ask our other guests how they feel about that dividing line. Professor Hawk, is that too stark, or do you think that's a fair place to start?
We certainly want to innovate AI that enhances our ability. McKinsey did a study 2 years ago that identified the jobs that are going to be obsolete. It's pretty clear that the jobs that require manual labor are going to be gone. But they are also able to identify the jobs that's going to be high in demand. It's your creative ability. Be able to tell a good story, write well, show empathy to people, collaborate, be a team player. And one question that researchers are asking, can AI be used to sharpen some of the skills? And I think that's the future we want to head towards. Can AI improve some of the skills of human that cannot be automated easily by machines?
You're also drawing on an idea that we hear often throughout history, which is that whenever there has been technological gains, there have been calls like I did at the outset that the sky is falling. You know, the horse and buggy industry was very worried that those jobs would be lost. When the automobile came along, the job shifted. Do you see this as a shift in work? In other words, automation might require or remove the need for much manual labor, but those jobs will move to more creative fields? Or do you worry about the net loss?
I think AI will create more jobs. It will kill professions. So it will get a lot more opportunity in other space, like technical skills, creative skills, arts, mathematics. So I think there's whole notion about future of work. How do you educate the future of young generation to have those skills? So there will be a lot more opportunity for those. But for manual labor, perhaps, it's not so good.
Okay. Professor Hosseini.
I want to kind of draw this little difference between the different type of AI that we're talking about. When we're talking about AI, AI is really good at doing specific tasks, tasks that require recognizing patterns or tasks that require to reason about uncertainty. These are the tasks that usually are very cumbersome for human beings. We are not able to do a lot of these tasks over time. We are not able to look at the expected actions or expected outcomes of the tasks that we want to do. So those are the tasks that those type of jobs that require those types of tasks are the ones that are going to be probably replaced. However, at the same time, AI is going to open up a lot new opportunities. So in that case, I actually agree with Ehsan that it is going to create new opportunities for new creative type of work, the work that require thinking, the work that require us to go back to the humanity part of us, to the part that we are we're good at creating arts, we're good at developing new things. So those are the tasks that, those are the type of jobs that we're going to see more in the future. However, I also agree with Matt's concern about the fact that we got to be conscious about this. We got to be very careful about how we are going from this step to the next step. The example that we can think about is that if you look at the Industrial Revolution, at the time, there were a lot of people, the workers, working in the manufacturing fields. And now we don't see a lot of workers in manufacturing fields. In fact, most of those jobs have been replaced by the jobs that at the time no one would have ever imagined.
So I want to listen to a little bit of an exchange that Yang had regarding truck driving. So this is an example of the kind of job that could be scaled down tremendously with automation. And what he was talking about with the podcaster Joe Rogan was his conversations with truck drivers that I referenced at the outset. And then once they considered AI, what they thought should be done. What you will note in this exchange is that Joe Rogan hears what the truck drivers are saying, and he thinks, you can't do that. You can't stop this. Let's listen.
I've been campaigning for president now for a number of months, so I spend a lot of time in Iowa, which is a really huge trucking hub. And you go to them and say, hey, guys, you worried about robot trucks taking your jobs? They're like, there's no way a robot could take my job. Like, that's like totally matter of fact. They're like, this is not something that they worry about. Mm. Their attitude has transitioned from that somewhat to we should make robot trucks illegal, or we should make it so that a robot truck cannot displace me. So that's been a big shift, because a year ago they were like, it's impossible.
The idea that an American would say we should make a robot job illegal, like it's, we should have some laws that keep you from being free to use robots for your business instead of a person. Like you should be forced to hire, like mandatory unionization or something. That sounds pretty ridiculous.
All right. So Matt Kelly, does that sound ridiculous to you?
In that particular clip, yes, I can understand where it would sound ridiculous. I guess what I'd like to push back with a little bit is why we have this presumption that manual labor will become obsolete or even should become obsolete. And I'm not saying that we necessarily have the answers here for that, but that's something I'd like to inject into the conversation.
Well, does it worry you?
Yeah, it does worry me. I will tell you this. It worries me to think that manual labor will become obsolete, that it would become a hobby or a niche or something that people have to seek out on their own time. I think, knowing what the McKinsey report said, my first question is, how many poets do we really need in this world? Like, if we're all going to be focused on creativity, how many painters
do we need? Well, it's not all poetry.
I understand that. But I guess what also maybe even frustrates me a little bit is this presumption in this kind of larger conversation that manual labor is not creative, that it doesn't require thinking. I mean, even working the vineyards out in the Finger Lakes is skilled labor. I mean, picking grapes is not unskilled labor.
No, that's actually a very interesting point, because there are so many different systems of growing the grapes, of trellising, when to pick, how to pick by machine, by a hand, etc., that when you automate the task, you get a uniformity of product, but maybe not even the best product. And that there is, that's much more creative. I hadn't thought about that as an example.
Well, and here's where I would continue with that line of thinking is I think we are at a point as a culture, as a society, even as a species, thinking about, we need to not only be thoughtful about our technology and what we're producing, but we also need to be thoughtful about what gives us meaning. I mean, so much of what we do, whether it's creative and intellectual, whether it's manual and productive, these are the things that give humans meaning. And I don't want to take the show in a completely different direction, but I would also argue that a lot of the issues that we are likely seeing in our society today are based on the fact that people don't have meaningful things to do. And producing things with your hands and digging in the soil and getting elbow deep, you know, in the earth or under a car hood is something that is meaningful. You can see your effect on the world. You can see the change you're making. And I just want to kind of inject that in that conversation as we're talking about tools versus replacement when it comes to AI.
Enhancement versus replacement. Yeah. So let me, Eitan, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
So if you want manual labor, you can always work out in the gym. But joking aside, half of my job is all about scheduling meetings, responding to emails, which is tedious labor. I want to delegate the task to somebody else, maybe to AI, so that I have more time to do thinking, to be able to innovate. I think many people feel that way, to be able to have time to yourself to read a new book, learn more about new things, get new skills. If you get bogged down with this manual labor that you don't enjoy doing, if you do enjoy doing, feel free to do so. But if you don't enjoy, there is an opportunity for you to delegate it to somebody else so you can spend your time more meaningfully. And I think that's what we're discussing here.
And can I just probe a little bit before I turn to Professor Hosseini on that point? I think of doctors, for example. They would love, in the same way that you as a professor would love more time for thinking, for creative work, doctors would love more direct time with patients. They are bogged down in the kind of work that I am sure they are hoping AI limits the need for them to be doing paperwork, etc. So I get that. But what I hear you saying, Eitan, is, you know, if you like doing manual labor, you'll be able to do it. But maybe not in the case of agricultural industry. If we remove those jobs with automation, sometimes to the detriment of an overall product, but just because we can, no one is going to be digging in the dirt for the fun of it if they have to make a living somewhere else. And if they're scrambling to do it, I don't know who's going to end up doing that. And maybe I just can't see it.
I think that's why the transformation needs more time, discussion. I'm glad that we're having this conversation. Mm-hmm. So we need stakeholders from many different spaces, not just AI researchers making the decision, but people who would be impacted by it should be part of the conversation as well.
And then one other point is whether you think we can stop this kind of technology or if it's inevitable. In other words, if it becomes available, if we can get it within our grasp, are we going to deploy it, or we as a society, can we have that values conversation to say, you can do this, but we're not going to? Do you think it's inevitable?
Right now, a robot displaces 5 people in industry. So for an owner of industry who believes in the revenue, they're probably going to go after it. So it needs to be managed by an upper administration.
At least in a capitalistic society, it's probably inevitable.
Right, yep.
You want to add to that before I turn to Professor Hussain?
Well, no. I think one of the things that Ehsan said that is really fascinating is this idea is if I can get rid of, I mean, I'm all on board with getting rid of menial tasks in my day to be focused on the things I want to do. That, to me, sounds like a great conversation to have about the potential for AI. Because I can tell you, farmers want to spend time outside among their crops with their vineyards. In this case, their vineyards, you know, doing the things they love connected to the earth. Paperwork, taxes, paychecks, all these other things that you have to do to run a farm have to be taken care of. But if we could reasonably have an AI tool that could take care of those successfully, I could see that being a huge benefit to getting people. I mean, if the conversation we're having is about leveraging AI, not just to get people into those creative jobs, but getting into the jobs and the real meaningful tasks that they want to have. Yeah, I think across the board, as a journalist, I would love that. And one thing I just want to say real quick, when Evan and I were talking about the New Yorker piece in which the journalist was looking at how AI might write his story as he was actually writing his story about the AI, another journalist used the same AI not to write her story, but as a partner. So she would get in this sort of, you know how you get writer's block and you're like, oh, I'm kind of stuck. She would, by using this tool, drop in some paragraphs from her story and then it would spit things back or ask her questions. And it was like, oh, that just helped me get past the writer's block ad. So the same device used for two very different purposes, replacement versus enhancement. So,
Professor Hussaini?
Yeah, I want to go back to what Matt mentioned about manual labor, and I want to make a distinction between what we'd call manual labor, and I don't even know if there is a standard definition of manual labor out there. But there are tasks that AI is really good at. As I mentioned, like for instance, when we talk about narrow AI, what it means is that we have vacuum cleaners that they can do a really good job, and a lot of people are using them. I mean, they're really good job. They're not perfect, but they're doing a really good job. But at the same time, there are different types of labor that so far, none of the AI, none of the robots are able to do that. Think about like a chef preparing a dinner, preparing some meals. And these are the things that even though we think of them as a manual task, but at the same time, we don't have any AI that is capable of doing all these tasks because it requires multiple different types of tasks working together at the same time. And we are far from having to eliminate all of the manual labor. And that's I don't think that is the purpose of AI. Another example that comes to mind is caregiving. So if you think about caregivers, caregivers to elderly or patients, these are the people that you can never replace with something like an AI because you really, really need to have that human touch at the end. And interestingly, there's a lot of research also showing that caregivers also benefit from giving care to caretakers and to patients at the same time.
You want to add to that, Max? Go ahead.
Well, I think this is really then becomes a question of the thoughtful application of AI, right? Like, that's really what we're talking about.
I mean, on the note of thoughtful application, I'll tell you a story. One of the most prominent banks came up to us and told us that we want to be able to build a technology to look at the performance of the call center employees to see how well they're answering phone calls, what's going on in their voice intonation, so they can look at who is doing a good job so you can reward them. And I immediately noticed there is a problem with the solution because that will lead to surveillance of the employee who is doing well, and that's not good. So what we told them is, how about giving them a tool to empower them? So what do I mean by this? Have you guys worked in a call center before? Mm-mm. It's a very stressful job. When people call in and complain, you have to be able to mitigate the situation and make sure the angry caller is calm. It's very stressful. So imagine you have a dial, and if somebody's calling and yelling at you, if you want, you can use the dial to change their pitch to make them sound like a kid. So imagine a kid yelling at you. It's not stressful at all. So you're able to really manage your stress and mitigate with the situation. So we proposed a solution that used it, and then employees' performance went up. Employees are happy. The company was happy. So there is, you know, going back to Matt's point, there's a creative way to deploy that technology.
Enhancement, so, but not replacement.
Exactly.
But when I hear Rogan, who, by the way, I like Joe Rogan a lot. I mean, he's doing 3-hour podcasts, and you can see his thinking evolve in real time, and that's fine with me. I actually think that that's really an interesting exploration. But when he says, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, you can't pass a law to say that we're not going to create this technology or we're not going to deploy it in certain ways. That's not the only way that we as a society can do this. It's not necessarily just about creating laws. I mean, I think I'm with Eysan when the idea is in a capitalistic society, it's probably inevitable because there might be perceived competitive advantages economically, so it's probably hard to stop it. But I tend to come down with Weissman when he says we're being a little too lazy and assuming it's always inevitable, that we can have the values conversation. And that values conversation might include changing economic systems. I don't know. I think that's why you have this now. So I'll ask the professors in the room. Part of the Yang campaign is founded on this idea that it is inevitable that AI and automation are coming. It is disrupting fields, and we will not replace the jobs. It's time for a universal basic income. That will be sort of the backstop. I mean, do you view this as a backstop time, or is this just another transition in work kind of time?
I really don't see it that way. The way I see this is that this technology is going to come, and the fact that the technology is inevitable, that's true. But I don't think that's the same as saying that all the jobs are going to be gone and it's going to replace all the jobs. In fact, this is the time for us, and many of the researchers actually in the community of AI have started thinking about ethics of AI, creating like more thoughtful AI. And these are the times that we are actually have to get into the game and try to kind of make sure that the AI that we're building is actually empowering people rather than taking away from it. But I want to mention something that you pointed to. It's about economics. And I think that's these two things are going to go hand in hand. There's no way that you can handle one of these problems. You can deal with one of the problem with the AI and getting rid of jobs without looking at economics and without looking at the economy as a whole for the people. So, yeah, that's a worry that I have. And that's something that I think it's good that we have this conversation among the politicians as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I think also, you know, we don't have unfettered capitalism in our society now. We place plenty of expectations, regulations, rules on businesses now in terms of how we can do business in a fair and just manner, right? I mean, what? Industrial Revolution, you're going to crack a few eggs. You're going to lose a few people in the mill. That's just business, right? Well, we changed that, right? We were thoughtful. We were caring. We put human life as a priority above profit. And we structured not only our laws and regulations, but our societal expectations appropriately. I see the same thing being able to happen with AI. This idea that, no, we're not just going to toss people out the door and hope that they all start doing something that they enjoy and whether or not they get $1,000 a month, things are going to work out for them. It's like, no, we're going to do this thoughtfully. If we're going to implement AI in our industrial systems, in our corporate systems, let's do it in a way that makes people more productive, not more obsolete.
But maybe that's where Rogan's right, and maybe that's where, to Eysan's point, maybe in a capitalistic society you can't.
I don't buy that.
With the, capitalism.
Capitalism isn't gravity. It's not a universal constant. We can shape our systems to be however we want them to be.
No, that's an interesting and a fair point. And before I get to some listener feedback, listeners, as we talk about AI and the future of AI and our expectations for the benefits and the potential risks, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, and connections at WXXI.org. I do want to ask, in particular, the professors in the room, but, you know, Matt and I kind of talked about something that's related, but it's not exactly related. When I think about the risks of AI, I think about a book that I read called Our Final Invention, and it's the paperclip idea. It's the model that says if we have advanced AI and we task it with creating paperclips, and it creates all the paperclips it can with the materials you give it, and then it's out of materials, and whoops, it starts creating paperclips with everything it can find in its sight, including people, we're in trouble. Because it's going to complete the task one way or another. I know it sounds sort of ridiculous, but here I'm reading this piece on Vox. A new release from OpenAI shows how complex behavior emerges. This AI learned how to play hide-and-seek, came up with its own strategies. I want to read from this Vox piece. The results from this simple setup were quite impressive. Over the course of 481 million games of hide-and-seek, the AI seemed to develop strategies and counter-strategies, and the AI agents moved from running around at random to coordinating with their allies to make complicated strategies work. And along the way, showed off their ability to break the game physics in unexpected ways. It's the latest example of how much can be done with a simple AI technique called reinforcement learning, where AI systems get rewards for desired behavior and are set loose to learn over millions of games the best way to maximize their rewards. Does that worry you, Matt Kelly? It makes me a little uneasy because I am not a scientist. I am ignorant. I look at that and I think, should I be worried here? Do you worry?
Well, I think you should be worried, but that doesn't mean we have to be fearful necessarily, right? I mean, I think this is, again, this is where we are thoughtful about things. So there are numerous examples that don't often get talked about how AI surprises us, right? So again, if you think about AI as a black box with input and output, and we really don't know what happens within that box. We know what goes in and then we know what comes out. And sometimes it's awesome and sometimes it's like a head scratcher. That in, you know, the hide and seek case is one of those things. There was a bunch of input and then the output was astounding. And watching the video of those little AI creatures do their stuff was amazing. Highly recommend.
Yeah, there's video on the Vox piece that you ought to check out.
Highly recommend it to everybody. But I think that, so other examples of these surprises are things like we've talked about before, which is, you know, Facebook was training their chatbots with AI, and then the chatbots started talking to each other in their own language that they created. That's kind of quirky, right? Some of these evolutionary scenarios that scientists have set up have been like, we need a creature to move from point A to point B in a certain amount of time. And they're picturing wings and legs and however a creature might do it. Creature builds itself as tall as the distance and then falls over. So, you know, AI is going to do some
quirky.
Didn't predict that. So what worries me is the black box of this all, not understanding why an AI is making the decisions it's making. Again, any other tool, hammer, car, iPhone, I can open up and take a look inside. Now, let's take an iPhone. I may not understand what all the circuitry is doing, but somebody can.
Yeah.
I can also open up an iPhone and tell you whether certain things are broken. Like, I can look inside and make those changes. If we're not able to do that with AI...
If we lose that ability
and that capacity, that's when I go from worried to fearful.
Okay. Ehsan?
Well, I just want to talk about Facebook, but before that, I will talk about some invention that happened in the past. For example, telescope was invented in 1608, and that led to the theory of optics in 1650. Steam engine was invented in 1695, and that led to thermodynamics in 1824. Computer was invented in 1941, and computer science, the study of computer theory, was invented in 1950 and beyond. So yes, we don't know a lot about deep learning, but we are making progress in there. But I'm hopefully from there, it will lead to new theories as to how it's working. So that's how many of this invention played out in the past. It's not the first time. And going back to the Facebook story, I can imagine that's a non-computer scientist that's very fearful to read a piece that says two computers are talking to each other nonsensical or created their own language. But in reality, I'll tell you what happened. So they wanted to have two bots, two computer programs to negotiate with each other. And they had some training data of two human doing the negotiation. And they learn from that, like, okay, if I win the negotiation, what kind of language am I using? So those became features. And then they have this two computer playing those games randomly, you know, starting from randomly. And then they had no language understanding. They were looking for those features, and they were passing the knowledge to each other so they can learn from each other. So that was the output that we noticed. But from the outside, it may appear like they found a new language to talk to each other, but it's not one the case.
Okay.
I want to go back to that, and it's kind of interesting because from my perspective, and this could be really my opinion, and I would like to know what Ehsan thinks about this, is that there's nothing in AI that actually surprises me. And I don't know, I'm saying this as an AI researcher, and I can understand if you're not in the field or if you're not familiar with how it works, it will really, really surprise you. But as an AI researcher, I've never opened up a paper that at the end of the day, or I've seen a piece of news which actually surprised me. So in this case, we kind of dealing with these two types of learning. I mean, going back to what Ehsan was mentioning about feature selection in learning or learning without feature selection, which today is called deep learning. And the idea was that the traditional machine learning algorithms, you had to specify, as a designer, as an AI researcher, we had to specify, these are the features that we want the AI to, we want this classifier to learn, we want this algorithm to learn. But today, we don't need to actually do that. We're going to give a lot of data to the algorithm, and we're going to tell the algorithm, you choose whatever feature you want to choose. But at the end of the day, we are the one feeding the algorithm with the data. So it's not, whatever it's learning, it's not that surprising to me. And I would like to actually know your take on that.
Well, as an AI researcher, your algorithms are working. It's not surprising. It's satisfying. But what's surprising to me is that the overall interest from many different places and the fact that people are having interest in this, having conversations, that's exciting. And going back to Hadi's point that in the last 2 years, we have generated 90% of the world's data. So we are generating a lot of data. And only 1%, let's say 1% to 2% of the data is labeled. The rest is not labeled at all. So with the deep learning now, we can go back and take a look at this unlabeled data, learn new things. And sometimes we can't explain it, but we are working towards it. But let me ask a question back to Matt and
sure.
Evan. So imagine you have two robots, and they're performing an operation on you. In one case, there's a 97% probability that it can save you with no explanation. In the other case, it has an 85% probability that it can save you with an explanation. So which one would you opt for?
That's a false choice.
You think it's
a false choice? I do. I think it's a false choice. I think it's an excellent question to ask back, and I appreciate what's being asked. I understand, you know, again, the whole idea that, and let's take this into a completely different direction. It's like, how many people understand how their feet work? Like, literally, how many people understand the mechanics of their feet? Yet we use them every day, right? Because experience has shown me that 100% of the time, they're pretty much going to work. In my case, it's 95% of the time. But, you know, so, you know, I'll still rely on my feet. I guess the argument that I would make is not necessarily that I need to understand the explanation, but that somebody needs to.
Okay. And do you accept that, Ehsan?
Well, with the assumption that understanding is binary, whether you understand it or not, sometimes understanding could be partial. Even human understanding on any topic is partial.
So this is where my uneducated mind, here's where I go with that. If the task is, if I have cancer, and we're at a future where we're not sort of crudely attacking cancer the way we do now, we've got different options. And AI's task is to kill the cancer, to stop the cancer. AI could decide that as long as it just kills me, the cancer dies with me. That would be a bad outcome. And if we didn't understand AI's process, we just allowed it to figure out what its task was, that could be a bad outcome. I would want to know. But am I being alarmist when I worry about that?
Absolutely. And I think if you want to trust AI with that kind of high-stake decision, there has to be a lot of checkpoints in place.
I just want to ask, is that a fair question to ask?
That is absolutely fair question to ask.
Okay. So, but I'll get back to your first question before I turn to Professor Hosseini. Then we got to get a break. We're going to take some phone calls. And I know Steve, we're going to take your call. Tom, we got a lot of feedback here. I think I'm largely with Matt when I say, the 85 versus the 97. I'm going to take the 97 because I'll probably roll the dice in that way. But I still feel like if we get to a point where no one can explain decisions, I'm going to be nervous. What I'm hearing from our guests in the field is a little bit more comfort there, that we're not necessarily at that point. But go ahead, Professor.
I just want to challenge the question that Ehsan asked. So in that question, there's a little bit of a subtlety inside the question, which doesn't tell me how your algorithm, what type of data your algorithm used to get to 97%. If I'm the patient, that is the question that I would ask. I would ask, well, is this data coming from people who are like similar to me or from the same features and all that or not? Or is this the data that related to something else that was fed to the algorithm? So the question is interesting. I give you that. But at the same time, there's a lot of subtleties.
I think Professor Hosseini brought a very valid point that in the future, it's not about the algorithm. It's actually the data that's going to control who has the power. And that's another discussion should be having. Should companies be allowed to have a lot of data about ourselves? Because that's dangerous for the society as well as AI research in general.
I am way late for our only break. We should have had both hours on this. But listeners, let's get to your phone calls and emails after our only break as we discuss and debate the future of AI. You just heard Professor Ehsan Hawk, who is the Asaro Bigger Family Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Rochester. Hadi Hosseini is here, Assistant Professor in the Department of Computer Science at RIT. Matt Kelly is an independent journalist. And me asking all the ignorant questions. Your questions after this break. Coming up in our second hour, Mark Zuckerberg says Facebook essentially cannot ban or vet all political ads. Twitter says those ads are disallowed now. And critics say that Facebook has to do a much better job because misinformation spreads and it does real harm. Well, whose job is it to correct that? Is it Facebook's? Is it yours? We talk political ads and our responsibility coming up. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To the phones we go, and in Livonia, this is Steve. Go ahead, Steve.
I caught the program just as you were talking about the autonomous vehicles for transportation, freight, and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming this is probably applicable to a lot of industries. It could actually, autonomous vehicles could solve some problems in the freight business because there's a chronic shortage of drivers. I read some research somewhere that like the average age of truck drivers is about in the high 40s or low 50s. Mm-hmm. Kids are just not choosing to go into that field. So I think in that respect, it could actually help. And there's also limitations on how long a human being can drive any given time when they're moving long haul across the country. They got to have 10 hours of maximum drive, and they got to take 10 hours off. If you had an autonomous vehicle, even with a person in it, they could drive pretty much straight through from California to New York and save a lot of time, and everybody's wanting to get their stuff as quick as possible these days. So I've been in the freight business 20 years, and it's evolving, but I don't know if automation would take care of all of it, but definitely would help in this driver shortage.
Steve, thank you. That's a very interesting perspective that, frankly, I think probably gets lost a little bit. There are certain jobs that eventually become dangerous if workers are overworked, and perhaps AI automation can help. So that would be it. I would put that in the category of a supplement, Matt Kelly. If company workers are driving 12, 16-hour shifts, long hours cross-country, that's not always safe.
That sounds like a great tool. I mean, that sounds like a great tool to put in the cab of a truck, absolutely.
Yeah, as opposed to saying that worker's job's gone entirely. Fair, Ehsan? Yeah?
Yep, and I think I'm going to go down my limb and say that it's very unlikely for a car to drive on its own, and even in the future, because the legal implications are huge. So even the solution we're going to have probably human driving together.
You're the first person in AI who's agreed with me on this. I feel like, and I love you all, my lawyer friends, my dad's a lawyer, but I feel like our litigious society, we have a society where we are horrible drivers. Thousands of people die and are injured in car accidents. We know this, but at least we get to takes some level of control. We could reduce accidents by 95% with AI, but in the 5%, if you lose a loved one because AI screwed up, you're going to sue them for about $16 trillion, and that's going to be the end of it. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. As well as a trolley problem, there are a lot of nuances. Even if it's 99% correct, yeah, even for the 1%, the legal implications are significant.
Yeah.
So I want to mention that, so on this one, I actually think that humans are very error-prone, so having humans driving, especially like long hours, it's going to create a lot of accidents, a very unsafe thing. I don't know. I imagine like 100 years from now, people are going to look back and say, "Oh, how did we even trust humans to drive a car?" Like you can, but at the same time, I agree that there's a lot of legal implications, lots of ethical implications. There is some work being done at MIT that they're kind of creating something called, they call it moral machine. I don't necessarily agree or disagree with them. But their idea is that because these problems, like the trolley problem, are very sophisticated, very difficult, who is going to be in charge? Is it like the engineer who has designed the AI? Is mm-hmm. it going to be the person who bought the car? Is it going to be the company? Who is going to be, at the end, responsible if, God forbid, like a car crash happened? And they have designed this what they call moral machine, where actually they ask people, they show different scenarios to people and they ask them, hey, what would you do? And their argument is that this is the aggregate judgment of the society. And if the aggregate judgment of society in the trolley problem says you have to go left and do this action, then we have to accept it. I don't personally agree with that. I'm just saying that this is one approach that
people
have.
That note, there's a scenario. Let's say I'm a passenger, and there's one sense there are five people that driver car can go kill, or they can sacrifice me. So, of course, many people say, of course, you should sacrifice the passenger than the five people. But then I'm never going to buy that car again. So there, that's the dilemma right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so interesting. So many calls and emails. Tom in Brighton. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. So much of this conversation is really about language and vocabulary and nomenclature. We distinguish human, what we call human intelligence, from artificial intelligence. But even the word intelligence, it's a word. And, you know, physicists would say that intelligence is just a localized reduction of entropy. And we use words like decision and choice. There is no evidence to even suggest that such a thing as choice or decisions exist. When an atom has an electron that goes from a high orbit to a low orbit, and then it emits a photon, it's called, you know, spontaneous emission, no one says that the atom decided to emit the photon. It's the inherent nature, the physical nature of that structure that produces the photon. And when we say, we talk about autonomous vehicles, well, when a Homo sapiens is driving a car, that is an autonomous vehicle. The person or the human is just as much a part of that car as the engine or the computer. So to some extent, this discussion is futile. It's a mechanistic universe. Everything in it is determined by physical processes. There are no decisions.
I can't believe that's true, but okay. Professor Hawk, I'll start with you. Is this futile? I think there is a distinction between human intelligence and machine intelligence, but go ahead.
Well, in the context of driving, if I know I'm independent while I drive, but if I make a mistake, somebody can hold me liable for it. But when an AI makes a mistake, who do you hold responsible? So that's the big thing.
I think he's saying that it's all various forms of intelligence.
It's very difficult to define intelligence, and that's actually a very good question. What is intelligence? I think this is a very philosophical question. I want to tell a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, one of my favorite novelists, who said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic," and that's that's how we feel about intelligence these days, and we're trying to associate what we call intelligent. In fact, even in the field of AI, up until 20 years ago, what we called AI or intelligent, these days they're just like regular expert systems, and no one really calls them like very sophisticated AI anymore. So our definition of intelligence actually changes and evolves over time.
Yeah, and I would just say, going back to Matt Kelly's point, Tom, I disagree with you in that when Arthur C. Clarke says any sufficient technology is indistinguishable from magic, when I was 3, my grandparents would turn the lights on in their pool, and it would have red and green lights. We called them the magic Christmas light. It was magic to me. Well, now someone can teach me how that works. We may get to a point where no one can ever teach me how certain automated machines are working, and that does seem like a different category. But on the subject of understanding language, we talk about AI and robots and algorithms, and you want a little distinction there, I think, between AI, robots. We kind of use them all as the same, don't we?
Yeah, I think what would be interesting to hear from the guests is kind of, you know, we do throw around algorithm, AI, and robot. They all seem to kind of get glommed together in any conversation we have. How would you define each of those? And I guess more importantly, what is the really sort of like takeaway distinction between them? How should we differentiate between them?
They're looking
as
at
everybody
each other.
Points to each other.
Right.
So let's start with this. What is an algorithm?
So in a very simple form, algorithm is just a simple set of instructions that you kind of go one by one and you basically operate these instructions. You just, if you think about like cooking, that's a good example that you have a recipe. Your recipe is basically the algorithm of how you do. It says, this is what you need. There are some ingredients. You need egg, you need flour, and you need different things. And then after that, it tells you how much time you have to spend on every step of that. right? So this is essentially what algorithm is.
So algorithms can be used by employed in different ways, but then how do you differentiate between AI and robot then?
Well, they would be the same because in a way, AI would mean a computer's ability to be able to take an external data, learn from it, and use that knowledge to be able to get a goal and adapt if necessary. So in that case, robots would be AI as well.
The way I would like to say, I mean, the way I think about this, again, these are like, is that a robot is the body and you can think about AI as the brain. That's the most basic definition I can give.
And so then an AI would be using algorithms
precisely
for all of the choices and decisions and output that it's creating.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Great.
Gene says, I feel like jobs such as caregivers, homeowner services like gardeners or landscapers, restaurants, etc., will never fully implement AI, and that eventually people that are willing to do this work will continue to ask and receive a better wage. Furthermore, shouldn't AI's goal be to decrease calls to call centers with better infrastructure? The same can be applied to technology itself. I'm often perplexed and frustrated with my technological devices. Just stand in a self-checkout line for a while and watch some people struggle. Nothing is seamless with people. That's from Gene. Does that assuage some of your concern, Matt Kelly?
I think it's great that people are fallible. I love it. I think that's what... No, seriously, yeah. I do. I mean, who wants... I don't... So how do I say this? Who wants to live in a perfect world? I mean... And this goes back to the sort of, and I forget the caller's name, but the caller who is arguing that all things are mechanical.
Tom,
Tom, all the things are mechanical in this world, and therefore you can't, you know, differentiate between intelligence and what really is intelligence. We live in a human world. I mean, this is what we do. And I guess this is where I feel like being thoughtful about the tools and devices and creations we bring into this world is really important is, sure, I firmly believe in the physical properties and laws and rules and discoveries in this world. I mean, I think so much of who we are isn't necessarily about politics or about economics. It's about biology. It's about how we've evolved. It's basic human needs, right? But to say that things are simply mechanical, I mean, this is a human world, and we want to keep it human.
Well, that's largely what's at the core of this conversation,
yeah,
I think, is what it means to be human, what it means to have value, and how to make sure that AI doesn't remove that.
But enhances that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ehsan.
Right. I mean, there's a quote by Mark Weiser who says, you know, a technology is profound when it becomes invisible, like the electricity, the Wi-Fi. And that's what we envision AI to be. It's going to be everywhere, but we don't see it. We don't think about it. We still go on with our mechanical life and make good connections, have a better life.
And that's a beautiful vision, I think. And here's another interesting perspective, which comes to us from Rita in Honeyway Falls. With respect to today's show on progress, it seems to be using the term AI as equivalent to automation of tasks that humanity is already doing. But there is also AI being used to accomplish new things to improve life for humanity that humanity is not already doing, such as advances in medicine. That's an interesting point. Not supplanting humans, but doing things that we have not been able to do yet. What do you think, Professor?
I agree with that. In fact, there are a lot of, I'm going back to what Ehsan mentioned, that there's a lot of applications of AI that's out there. It's pervasive in our everyday lives and we don't notice it. I mean, part of my research is on multi-agent systems, which kind of deals with how intelligent agents or entities kind of interact with one another. Some of the tools that have been developed there are actually being used right now in airports like LAX and JFK to provide security, like to enhance the security system in those airports. These systems are now being used in order to figure out how to distribute, let's say, perishable food from charities to home shelters. So it's out there, and we're using them. We're just not aware of the fact that the AI has been enhancing our lives.
30 seconds. Is that the best case scenario, that we almost don't even notice it, but it enhances our lives?
Yes, and talking about healthcare, we talked about driving, and there's 1 in 100 chance we may die in a car accident, but there is 1 in 15 chance we may die in Parkinson's. So imagine a computer ability to be able to look at some of the movement and be able to give you early diagnosis. So many of these use cases need to be identified so that we don't have to deal with these diseases.
That is a perfect way of enhancing the work that doctors are already doing, though, without replacing a job. And that, I think, is in our last 30 seconds, Matt Kelly, I feel like a push-pull, but I do see a future where AI can enhance in ways that don't always disrupt or take away.
Yeah, I think the telescope is a really interesting comparison to this. The telescope allowed humans to see things they had never seen before, right? And I think even using the hide and seek example, it showed us things that we would not have thought of or seen or been able to come up with because it just works in a different way. And I think that is a beautiful enhancement of what we can do with AI.
But it didn't necessarily surprise the researching guests in the studio, which is very comforting to me. So I want to thank them for their time and their expertise. Professor Hadi Hosseini and Professor Ehsan Hawk, thank you very much for your expertise this hour. We appreciate that.
Good to be here.
Let's continue. These conversations, as Matt and I talked for the better part of an hour before this program began, this is not a one-off conversation. This is an ongoing humanity conversation. So let's do it again, my friend.
I think that'd be great. Thanks.
We'll see you on the B Report and finally get a break from the vineyards, I hope, as harvest winds down in the Finger Lakes. That's Matt Kelly. More Connections coming up.